You have reached the Every Little Thing helpline. Please leave your spooky scary werewolf bar mitzvah question after the beep.
Hey there, ELT people. My name is Brenda, and I have always loved graveyards. And I was just curious to know, like, some of these, you know, graves have been there from the 1700s, the 1800s, and if you were to dig up that grave, what would you find? Like, what's in there? I'm dying to know.
Hello.
Hey, Brenda, it's Flora from ELT.
Hello.
So, do you have a cemetery thing?
I kind of do have a cemetery thing. Not like your more modern cemeteries. Those are like, you know, I don't really care about those. But the older ones just fascinate me. So like the Granary Burial Ground, it's in Massachusetts. They have quite the collection of nifty dead people, like Paul Revere or Sam Adams or John Hancock.
What is it about those graves that gets you fired up?
I think when you see proof that these people have died, then you know that those people have actually lived.
Like the graves are a portal into another time.
Yes. I mean, they're our founding fathers. Are they really in the ground just right there where I could walk on them?
And what is left of their bodies? That's what you called about.
Yes. I want to know what is in there.
And what do you hope is in there?
Okay. I would imagine there's not much wood left, but I would think there would still be some sort of structure of a box of some sort. And you would open it up and you would see bones. But I don't think necessarily a complete skeleton. And I think there would be clothes, like their old-timey colonial clothing, buckle shoes, and maybe the poofy shirts.
So, Brenda, you're imagining that you would bump into a skeleton with a poofy shirt.
Yeah, that's kind of what I would hope for. And if they had that tri-cornered hat in there, too, that would be just a bonus.
Brenda, to answer your question, we found someone who, like you, has a cemetery thing.
I love cemeteries. I've spent a lot of time in cemeteries.
Meet Nick Bellantoni. He dug into old graves professionally.
I'm the emeritus Connecticut State archaeologist. That means I'm retired.
In this role, Nick was called to the scene whenever a grave or bones turned up in unexpected places, like if a construction crew accidentally unearthed a coffin. So I didn't even know this was a job, but Nick had it for 30 years.
Basically, I got involved with a lot of cases, both because historic graves were uncovered or because of modern criminal investigations.
Wow.
So Nick has investigated graves from the time period you called about, the colonial period. And I think we should start with outerwear, the coffin.
In that time period, say about the time of the American Revolution, coffins were usually banged out by a local carpenter. Sometimes they weren't always made to fit to individuals. We've seen that.
Like people were stuffed in, is that what you mean?
Yeah. We see sometimes the skeletons are very shrugged. And there was one case in New York where a burial actually had the lower legs removed and placed higher in the body because it wouldn't fit the length of the coffin.
Feels like you could just do a little planning and save yourself a lot of trouble.
That's right.
Is there any wood left over from the coffin?
Nick said that in New England's acidic soils, that wood is gone.
The wood rots, it decays, it decomposes, but the hardware nails stay in place.
And so those nails can be used to make a reconstruction of the coffin.
So we could actually do a kind of a CAD three-dimensional of the particular coffin.
Mm.
So now let's get to the clothing, your floofy shirt, buckled shoes hypothesis. Now, this really depends on what the body went into the coffin wearing. And in colonial times, the answer is not much.
You know, when you go back to the colonial period, people were primarily buried naked with sheets or a cheap shroud to cover them. Clothing was very expensive back then. You know, it was hand-woven. And so families passed clothing on to their brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles, whomever, and kept it in the family.
Definitely no tri-corner hat. So not much casket, no clothes. But let's get to the part we've been waiting for. What about that body?
Yeah.
Here again, a big factor is the soil.
Here in New England, including Boston, the soils here are rather acidic, and that means that organic remains do not do very well in the ground.
So what does that mean in terms of body status?
I've seen early 20th century graves where everything was gone, completely decomposed, ashes to ashes.
Including the teeth and bones?
Well, yeah, the teeth are the last to go, so to speak. The enamel that covers our teeth is the hardest substance in our body. So I had one burial experience where all I had was enamel.
So just like a set of chompers?
Set of chompers. Just think of without the roots, just what exposes when you smile. That's all that was left.
Brenda, how are you coping with this information?
Yeah, I have to say I'm a little deflated. Nothing but maybe chompers and some nails. Yeah, it's disappointing. I thought for sure there would be a little bit more than that.
Well, I have good news for you, Brenda. Because there are some graves with more in the casket.
Oh.
You just have to leave the Colonial Cemetery and look at more recent graves.
We had a case in Danbury, Connecticut many years ago. They were doing construction and they were putting in a new office complex. And the backhoe operator's claw caught on something hard. When he jacked the claw up, metal came flying out. It was a cast iron coffin. We date to about 1870s. And so the coffin had maintained itself.
So it was sealed tight. Soil didn't come in contact with the body. And when that backhoe hit the coffin, steam started coming out.
It was not a very pleasant odor.
Steam?
Post-decompositional gases that had been contained. It was like popping a cork off a champagne bottle.
What an analogy.
Charming.
Yeah, I know. Thank you. So anyhow, when they went down there to look, there was a guy in a blue suit.
What did it look like, Nick? I need to know the details.
Oh, good grief. It blackened. Everything was shrunken in, kind of gaunt looking. But the amazing thing is, there was still soft tissue attached. So in other words, his gums, his eyebrows.
Well, that's a bizarre combination.
I know. I do not want my eyebrows to be the last thing someone sees of me.
Yeah.
Now for modern graves. How much of a body can we expect in those? Nick says, thanks to vaults and embalming, it could be a lot more than the eyebrows.
We have absolutely no idea how long a body will last today. And I would speculate hundreds, if not thousands of years.
Oh, yeah. Definitely burn me up and throw me away if that's the case. Yeah. Just let me go, you know?
Brenda, I want to give you one more thing to think about next time you're getting your cemetery fix.
Okay.
Even if there aren't skeletons and floofy shirts beneath your feet, Nick says that what is in cemeteries can tell you a lot about the past.
I like cemeteries because they are repositories of our history and our social behavior. When you look at cemeteries and you read tombstones, for example, they reflect the belief systems of the time and how we have changed. So, for example, when you go back to the age of the Puritans, the idea is you went to a graveyard to confront your mortality, that, you know, soon this was going to be you, and you better be ready. You better be prepared to face God. And so the tombstones have skulls with wings and different, sometimes crossbones, and sometimes you'll see an hourglass because your time is running out, or an epitaph that will read something like, death is to nature a debt due. I've paid mine, and so must you. When you get into the early 19th century, you start seeing more classical tombstones, weeping willows and Greek urns, and God now is less to be feared but to be loved. It's a whole different belief pattern coming in, and it's reflected in the tombstones. And then you get into the late 19th century, and you have the Gilded Age of these fabulously wealthy people that are building huge monuments to themselves and their families, and with mausoleums and so forth, as if to say, you know, in death, this is what we were in life. It's a reflection. And then, you know, you get into the 20th century, and we have become such a democratic people. And what happens is a tombstone is simply a last name. Bell and Tony. So what I love about cemeteries is they're us.
So there you go. A different way to think about cemeteries.
Yeah. Instead of being a a scary, gruesome place to just how it reflects us as a society. I kind of like it.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you too.
I have picked out my tombstone. The epitaph is going to read, "I knew this would happen someday."
ELT listeners also had some snappy epitaph ideas. Here were some that came in through the helpline.
Hi, Every Little Thing. This is Annette. When I die, I would like my headstone to say, "She had the right of way."
Hello, my name's Corey. I'm calling to talk about my epitaph. So I was walking through a cemetery playing Pokemon Go when it first came out. And for whatever reason, they're like hotbeds for Pokestops. So I saw one from the mid-1800s that struck me as very poetic. And the headstone took a quote from Macbeth, where Macbeth is in the throes of like psychological turmoil, having murdered King Duncan. And he says, "After life's fitful fever, he sleeps well," about Duncan. He's expressing that the dead are the ones truly at peace. So after life's fitful fever, he sleeps well. I like it.
Hi, this is David Hoisson calling. I wanted to actually get cremated and made into disc golf discs.
After the break, a spooky story from under the sea.
At the tone, please record your message.
Our next voicemail concerns the classic symbol of Halloween, jellyfish.
I was just kind of wondering, how do scientists track jellyfish when you can't really put tracking tags on jellyfish because they're jelly?
Hello?
Hey, Kira.
Hiya.
So that's a specific question. Do you have a lot of firsthand interaction with jellyfish?
Yeah, we get quite a few. We see a lot of moon jellyfish down here in Wales.
Moon jellies?
Yeah, they're like just little round ones and they have tiny tentacles and they've got like a four-leaf kind of clover pattern on the top.
And what's your position on them? Are you pro-jelly? Do they bother you at the beach?
I usually don't mind them. I tend to like chuck them back in the water with buckets and stuff.
Oh, you're like a jelly savior.
Yeah.
So you called about whether scientists could tag a creature made of goo.
Yeah. Jellyfish are just blocks of jelly, so how would you like tie anything around them?
Kira asked a really good question.
Kira, we ran your question by jellyfish biologist Lisa Ann Gershwin.
I've discovered so far 217 new species.
Lisa's dedication to jellyfish is as deep as the Mariana Trench.
My home I've named Villa Medusa, and I'm having a Michelangelo jellyfish huge mural painted in my home. The painter is coming tonight to do the second of three installments.
This is how you know you're in deep with jellyfish.
You bet.
So, Kira, regarding your question,
it is possible to put a tag on a jellyfish and keep it on for a little while, at least.
And the trick to tagging jellyfish comes down to a sophisticated adhesive substance called glue. With surgical glue, you can put a lightweight tag on the bell of a jellyfish.
Oh, it's like they're wearing little hats.
Yep. So that's the answer to your question. But given that we had someone on the line who commissioned a three-part jelly-themed mural in her home, I figured we might be able to paddle around for something a little juicier to leave you with.
Ooh.
And we found something. I was telling Lisa that I think of jellyfish as like serene blobs of goo. And she was like, "You're wrong.
They can be very, very dangerous."
Tell me about the most nightmarish jelly.
Oh, hands down the Irukandji. No question.
Kira, this is one of the most powerful sea creatures you've never heard of. Are you ready for this jelly?
Hit me with it.
The Irukandji jellyfish is small and completely clear. You can't see it in water. It's about half an inch tall, the body, but the tentacles go about 3 feet. And they're as fine as cobwebs. And when you get stung, it's really mild. It's just a little bit of a twinge, and it's really nothing. But then, about a half hour later, you start getting really, really sick. And I don't just mean sick to your stomach. I mean sick all over. You get super bad lower back pain, 10 out of 10 on the pain scale. It feels like an electric drill drilling into your back, or like being hit in the back with a baseball bat again and again and again.
Oh my God.
And you start getting nausea and vomiting, like vomiting every minute to 2 minutes for 12 to 24 hours. And that's just the lead up. So within a couple minutes of the back pain and the nausea and vomiting, the full syndrome, it's called Irukandji syndrome, the full syndrome hits, and you get shooting spasms and full body cramps and difficulty breathing and profuse drenching sweating. Nurses talk about wringing out the bed sheets every 15 minutes and all the dehydration that goes along with that. And you feel like you're suffocating. People describe feeling like there's an elephant sitting on their chest and a creepy skin feeling that some people feel like there's spiders crawling on the skin or worms burrowing in the skin. One woman described feeling like there was roasted chickens coming out of her skin.
That's insane. Chickens. Like, that's such an odd but specific description of what they were dealing with.
So in addition to all of that, patients also get a feeling of impending doom. It's not that they're afraid they're going to die. It's that they're positive they're going to die. And many patients beg their doctors to just put them out of their misery and get it over with.
That's insane.
The good news is that most people seem to make a full recovery.
Yeah. In fact, there's only 2 confirmed fatalities. We think there's been many more fatalities than that. But the funny thing is, it leaves no mark. And it leaves nothing to test for in the blood. So you can't tell unless you live to tell the story.
They're the perfect criminal.
Hands down. That's the scariest jellyfish I know of.
Honestly, like, that needs to be more known about, because to me, that's a lot more scary than a shark.
Exactly. These jellies live off of the northern coast of Australia, just so you can cross all of those beaches off your travel list. If you have a burning question, maybe one that makes you feel like roasted chickens are emerging from your skin, give us a ring. 833-RING-ELT.
Every Little Thing is produced by Kristen Clark, Bradley Campbell, Phoebe Flanagan, Aaron Reese, Annette Heist, and Flora Lichtman, with help from Nicole Pasulka and Doug Barron. Ian Chillug and Caitlin Kenny are our consulting editors. Scored by Dara Hirsch and Haley Shaw. Mixing by Dara Hirsch. 'Cause this is Thriller. Thriller Night. And no one's going to save you from the beast about to strike. Goodbye.